I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
Way back in episode 41, we spoke with grassroots economist Will Ruddock about how new digital currencies are being used to jumpstart economic activity in Kenya. Since its inception, the project has grown from a few thousand users to several hundred thousand. As it turns out, Will works in a public-private partnership with the Danish Red Cross that is funded by Innovation Norway and the Dowen Foundation.
Today, we are speaking with Adam Bornstein, leader of financial innovation at the Danish Red Cross. Adam's team supports local agencies to start and manage new currencies all over the world. This new form of humanitarian aid is empowering marginalized communities to thrive for the first time without direct outside intervention and without the need for a central bank.
Take a listen.
My name is Adam Bornstein, and I lead the Innovative Finance and Systems Change team for the Danish Red Cross. The reason why I got into humanitarian response actually started back when I was a student in China, and that was around 1993, and I was focused on going to Wall Street to become an investment banker. But when I got to China, I really understood the potential of international business. And as I got closer to the ground, while I was an equity analyst and I worked for a hedge fund and I started a couple of businesses, I really realized there was like this disconnect between the business world and the public sector, and each thought the other would solve the problems. And really what was needed was some kind of bridge. I didn't think I could do that alone, but I was really interested in playing a part in that. And so after about 15 years or so in private equity in Hong Kong and Asia, I joined the IFC, the World Bank, to be head of Mongolia. And that was kind of like a step into the space of, oh, it's development. That means there's some positive and then there's some commercial aspect of it. You know, that's a language I can speak. My wife's Mongolian, and half my family's Mongolian, and so Mongolia has a strong pull on my heart and also my sense. And I wasn't completely comfortable with how the World Bank would interact with countries locally, and I really felt like if I wanted to kind of go further, I had to kind of really get into the humanitarian space. So I essentially kind of like quit my bank career for a little while, or my investment career, and went and joined the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria, and that was my first kind of full-on engagement with finance ministers, health ministers in the global south, specifically around Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And so from that period on until I joined the Red Cross in 2018, I really had this kind of a quick steep curve to learn, you know, how that side of the table worked. And so when I finally got over to the Red Cross, and the Red Cross is like the world's largest humanitarian organization with 14 million volunteers and almost a million full-time staff, and we're 192 national societies. It was part of a team that would look at innovative financing across the entire Red Cross movement and how we can work together to kind of change that mindset, to change the paradigm. And now I'm in this really interesting space where we're looking at debt swaps, we're looking at structured finance, we're doing nature-based solutions, we're using blockchain technology. We're also thinking about procurement and then building these transformational partnerships across the movement.
Could you just give us a general one sentence about the project that you're doing?
Sure. Within the Red Cross, I look after the innovative financing and systems change team. And we intentionally put the word systems in there because the way we approach humanitarian response is from an ecosystem or value chain perspective. And so rather than saying that things are linear, we really look at this entire system as very complex. And as a result, we need to kind of look at the different levers that are within this system to be able to play with those to find the maximum leverage. And what I mean essentially is that if we're continually doing humanitarian assistance the same way over and over and over again and expecting to get this different results, you know, that's just not going to happen. So what we try to do is think about why is something happening? What's the root cause for that? And how can we approach it differently? And in this case, with the community inclusion currency program, it was originally founded on the basis of refugees and how can we support refugees who are crossing borders to provide them with some kind of liquidity and medium of exchange, so that as they're moving between different host countries or different communities within a host country, that they have ways to buy and sell goods and to have some kind of agency. And so what the basic fundamental principle is that we wanted to have a blockchain-based or a digital response recovery and resilience program that we could present to communities so that they could take hold of their own engagement and allow them to self-select into a program that would then give them some residual benefits over time. So rather than just plying them with capital, we gave them tools to build this resilience and to recover. And that's what community currencies essentially is.
That's a lot. Okay. So maybe we could just back up to the beginning when you move from essentially kind of standard traditional finance, you know, and equity analysis and management to humanitarian work, and that disconnect that you experienced. How, you know, what graphically was that disconnect? How does it look, and why is it so compelling? Is there some root reason why there's such a disconnect between the private world and, you know, kind of the humanitarian world?
Yeah, recently I was in a conversation where there were several leaders from the Red Cross around a table, and we were talking about, you know, why the Red Cross needs to lead in some of these areas around private sector engagement and structuring. And what I was hearing from very senior leaders within the movement was that really, let's let the private sector do it. They know better than we do. They know how to do these things. And, you know, my position was, they know how to do it in their context, but not in our context. They don't understand where we're coming from, or what our shared experiences are, or what our principles are, the way that we do. For example, do no harm. And another good example would be in blockchain. Working with the community inclusion currencies with Will and Grassroots, we've been through a couple different blockchain protocols and different types of chains, because the authority or the governing principle behind that ecosystem wasn't in sync with what our own beliefs were. So not only does it happen, say, in the kind of traditional banking world, but it also happens in the technology world. And this isn't just governance, it's also around gender equality. Whatever's replicated, whatever, you know, the technology world is really a mirror of our own society. And so if you want to be a change agent, you need to do it from a complete universe perspective, from a complete value chain, from a complete ecosystem perspective. And someone has to stand up and say that this is what we want to do. And that someone, I believe, is the Red Cross, together with some fantastic partners. When we looked at the insurance space, we said to ourselves, okay, we can go and buy an insurance cover for a typhoon or cyclone from XYZ insurer. For us to do that, we'd pay them a premium. But they're going to go to another organization to then kind of reinsure that product. And then there's going to be another modeling agency there. And then there's going to be a broker. And then there's going to be a clearing and an administrator. And by the time you're done with it, you know, 40, 50, 60% of your cost is just intermediary. So why can't the Red Cross in some ways become the insurance agency? Why can't we be that reinsurer? And that's basically what we did with this volcano catastrophe bond. And we worked with a group called Replexus. This guy, Cedric Edmonds, who is out of Zurich. And also with our partners from Barcelona Supercomputer Center called Mitiga Solutions, Alex and Hubert and his team. And together, you know, we were able to create this sort of reinsurance product that sat on blockchain, that basically cut out most of that middle area and now allows us to issue insurance directly from that single platform. And that's kind of the same principle as to, like, why is there a disconnect, and what that is the fact that, one, everyone is waiting for someone else to do it. Two, we don't quite understand each other's values or what the commercial offering would be from the private sector or the humanitarian offering from the nonprofit side.
I would like to dive deeper into refugees, because that topic seems to be always, has always been, and probably, I don't, for some reason at the moment, it seems to be a really hot topic. You know, I think this is, I mean, I'm saying this because we seem to have this kind of right-wing shift, at least here in Europe. And it's very concerning. And a lot of what I hear politically goes against refugees, goes against immigration. And if we're realistic, there will be even more. No, we will have more refugees. There will be more asylum seekers. There will be more immigrants. It shouldn't be a problem. What is it? How does the Red Cross this address? And when it comes into blockchain, I wonder what is the crossroad here? What is the mix?
So, again, when it comes to refugees, internal displaced people, and migrants, there's a couple principles that we follow. The first one is to let them make their decision and not to prevent them or to guide them one way or the other. The other is that if they are going to go down a certain path, we want to make sure that they have access to healthcare, that they have access to some support, that they have information. And then the other number three would be around thinking about the host community. And if we create programs or support mechanisms that only focus on migrants or only focus on refugees and not on the host communities, then we're ignoring a huge population and you start to create a divide, and that do no harm principle then becomes problematic. That when you have refugees in communities, and they could be, you know, 500,000 to a million. I think Uganda has like 1.3, Kenya has almost 500,000. It's a huge drain on the host resources. And so from where my team sits, what we look at is, okay, how can we use the talents and the skill sets and this idea of like community cohesion to the benefit of the country, and how to provide some skills to the refugees themselves. And community inclusion currencies are really good for that, because it creates a medium of exchange. We can create some liquidity for these communities and have that liquidity or that medium exchange backed by the goods and services of the community. So, for example, around agriculture and regenerative ag and syntropic agriculture, the idea being that we can issue tokens, and the tokens can be backed by the agriculture and the services that those communities are providing. So, for example, in Kenya, in Kakuma, we had a group of community members who saw the code or the telephone number that they could text for our community inclusion project. And they essentially texted it. They downloaded some tokens to their wallet. They self-selected amongst themselves. They created their own community. And then they started trading amongst themselves goods, for example, food and oil and services, without really any intervention from the Red Cross. That was, for me, the most ideal and elegant way for a community to engage in the programs that we have, when they do it themselves. And what they were trying to replace or to substitute or complement was that the World Food Program and UNHCR, essentially, they provide a couple kilos of grains. They have some kilo of cooking oil, and that lasts for, you know, half the month. But then what do they do the rest of the month? And so essentially what they were doing were, the refugees that were sitting in the camp were kind of integrating with the community outside the camp to grow vegetables and to create this kind of circular economy. And to me, that's a really classic example of how technology blends with humanitarian response in a refugee context.
Which is very different from just donations, just giving donation and basically creating a kind of a dependency on this capital flowing in.
Exactly. And so, to take it even a step further, is that when we do our cash transfer, when humanitarian organizations do cash transfer, essentially money will go into the community, and then within a day, that money is gone. It's gone because you'll have vendors that sit outside the camp, or they've just spent it on other goods. But if we use some kind of digital token or a token that, or an e-voucher that is for that community, that circulates in that community, it can't be exported as quickly. And so what we've seen is a value for money, right? So for every dollar that we inject in a community, and this could be in the form of like in-kind or actually fiat currency, we're getting anywhere up to 10 times value. And so what that means in terms of real terms is that if we put in, say, $200,000, right, then we're going to be getting a 10x multiple on that. If we put in a dollar, you're getting $10 back in value. And that's a real game changer when it comes to this type of work.
Yeah, that's spectacular. And this notion of being able to, you know, leverage your donor dollars into real, like, kind of empowering ecosystem, right? Or actually an economic system that's self-enclosed within these communities. And I just think it's brilliant, and it's such a great alternative to kind of traditional philanthropy and the way it's usually divided up. Can you discuss a little bit about how these inclusive communities could be expanded to other areas?
Sure. So the first step is that we wanted to create an open source toolbox so that other organizations can step in and use the technology or work with us to spin up their own solution. And that goes back to this kind of self-selecting idea. Like, if you build the tools and you have use cases, others are going to be able to pull it into their own wheelhouse and then shape it to suit their needs. And right now we're working with UNICEF in Kenya, World Food Program. We have GIZ, the French Development Bank. They're working with us in Cameroon. We're also looking at other kind of international organizations that are working with the Red Cross and grassroots specifically in terms of how do you kind of tailor this platform for their own needs. And I think what's interesting about it is that typically when you get funding for a project, it really is for that project. But we were lucky that we got money from Innovation Norway and Doen Foundation, who said to us that we really want you to create some kind of open solution, and we're not gonna hold you to this specific plan. Address the issues, course correct, and deliver a product that is like a public good. And I think that, you know, we raised about $1.3 million back in 2009. And since then, we've really been thinking about how we can support local communities directly. And typically funding will flow through the Red Cross or through an organization, will take an administrative fee, and then the rest of the money will flow to the ground. In this case, we really wanted to get that money directly to the organizations that are implementing it. And this is where like grassroots has played a really important role for us, is because, you know, they can then stand up and say that we will take in the funding and we'll directly implement it. And this is important because there's something called the Grand Bargain, which was signed in 2016. And it said that 25% of all funding for humanitarian support should go directly to the ground, like local and national organizations. But as of last year, it was around 2.1, 2.3%, down from 3.1% in the year prior. So, you know, it's pretty significant. And if we can actually support this and show how it can be done with multiple organizations, I think that's a really important win. The second thing then is that once you have this program and you're sort of rolling it out in specific use cases, you need to have the data that would support the evidence. And so recently we did a randomized control trial, and a master's student named Rebecca worked with us on this project. And what, you know, what the data shows is that if we transfer, say, $30 into a community, it's essentially going to increase the balance in the wallet. So if you put $30 in, that individual's wallet, their digital wallet, will see an increase of about $93, so about 3x. And there'll be basically another $23 increase in their monthly income, and then there's another $16 increase in spending. So just from that $30 increase, from that $30 kind of kernel or seed, you're getting from the result, this is from the RCT. We have higher results, but this, for this specific case, you're seeing at least a 3X, which is really interesting. And so you can take that to the bank and you can say, like, here are the actual results. Even if you're getting a 2X result, it's better than traditional financing.
I thought 25% was already quite low. And then just let's quickly repeat those numbers you just gave us. It was down from 3% to 2.5%.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that traditionally, when a humanitarian organization gets a grant from a donor, that money will go directly to the organization. And that organization will take maybe 7 or 11% administrative fees, just off the top. And then on the back of that, there's also like salary, there's, you know, procurement costs, things of that nature. And so once those things are kind of added into it, then that money, which is actually going into the ground, you know, will then support the program. And then there's slippage, like around transferring money, doing M&E. So it's essentially, it's that one step removed from actually getting the money directly to those that are going to be implementing it. Now, there's a reason for that, too, is because governance is a problem. And if you don't have a trusted party on the ground, that money can't go missing, and it has, right? So it's not that it's like predatory purposes. There's a reason for it. And so the question is how do you get more money to the ground without having to worry about whether or not it's being spent in an appropriate manner? And that's essentially kind of like, you know, what we're challenged with. And so with our community inclusion project, we're like, let's try and address that problem. Let's see how we can actually do something in that space that's different. And so obviously we have a strong relationship with Will and his team. And because we're using blockchain so that every transaction that takes place is recorded on a ledger, and then we have a dashboard which essentially allows us to see what's taking place in real time, we can then go ahead and say, okay, well, we know that we put money here. So how is that reacting? Like, what's the result of that? So, and because we have that transparency in real time, it allows us to feel more confident that, you know, what we're doing is kind of in line with the objectives. And as a result of that, we're able to then say, okay, you know, Grassroots, we're willing to support you in applying for a grant. That money can come directly to you. And as a result of that money coming to you, you can then go ahead and essentially use that, you know, as needed.
Adam, we are coming up to the end of our time here. And I just wondered, you know, with all the perspective that you have, you know, in your whole career, from private equity all the way through to humanitarian projects in Africa and South Asia, you just have such a breadth of perspective, and you must see also tremendous inequity and challenge in different communities. Where do you see, what's the big picture for you? Like, you know, are we gonna get there, and what's the vision, and how can we as listeners join in that vision?
A lot of it starts at home. And one of the privileges I have, I'm based in Vermont. I also support an organization that looks at community foundations. And what I think we can do is, the United States, for example, and the situations that we face at home in our communities are very similar to what communities face, and fragile communities and families face overseas. It might be inequity. It could be low income, job creation, you know, affordable housing, agency. Those are the same issues that every community faces in a different context, but really ultimately the same thing, which is resiliency. And so what I kind of pulled away from just a couple years of like living in these different types of environments is that resiliency is about adaptability. And not just taking care of your family, but also taking care of the community that you live in. And it sounds a little hokey, and I don't mean to go out there and walk people across the street or, you know, kind of help someone buy their medicine. I mean, taking a fundamental look at what your structures are based on and your systems and asking if that's the right way to do it. For example, in a community in the United States, if you're looking to put a new wastewater plant in place and you're basically going to go out and raise taxes or use the same technology as opposed to saying, hey, there has to be something better out here that might be cheaper and more environmentally friendly and regenerative, why are we not doing that? And sometimes it's because leaders or community members that don't necessarily want to see change have a stronger voice. So what it gets me to think about is really about youth empowerment and youth agency. And our roles as kind of the generation that's getting a little older to really create those opportunities for young individuals to step up and take leadership, and to then to be able to create those tools like we're doing in Kenya to allow people to self-select into those roles and to have that agency. That's one thing. And then another thing would be really about unlocking capital. That there, for example, there's $80 billion that sits in insurance products that are pledged towards US treasuries. The Red Cross has a funding gap, or the humanitarian sector has a funding gap of say $30 to $40 billion a year. If we keep going down the route of looking for grants, we're never gonna change that modality. We're never gonna fill that gap. So we have to start thinking like financial institutions. For example, why can't the Red Cross have their own bank? If we had our own bank or we had our own financial institution, we could use our brand as collateral or as a pledge or as a guarantee against future revenue. We could tap financial systems. We could tap that $80 billion and have investors and put money into an ESG Red Cross bond as opposed to US treasuries. So what it comes down to is really just looking at your space, thinking about an entire ecosystem, who the players are, where they're coming at, providing them with tools, and then really pushing hard for change.
Yeah, super interesting, you know, because Red Cross for me meant humanitarian aid. Donating blood.
Yeah, donating blood. That's what it means for me. And disaster relief.
And disaster relief, going into war zones, helping soldiers, wounded people. And here we are talking about currencies.
Well, it's not just currencies. I think what's cool about what Adam's saying is that the Red Cross has kind of is shifting from an organization who is about kind of direct service to one who's actually looking at the larger systems and the complexities of problems and trying to find out interesting and innovative solutions and currencies. The one that he has, this inclusive community or community inclusion project, is cool because it looks at all of the ways in which people need support when they're in trouble. And the refugee example is amazing. They need liquidity. They need a way to trade. If you just give them money, it gets spent. But if you give them a currency to play with, then they actually build business.
Right, and we really do need a different approach to this because all this donation system, as I don't know if we can call it this way, but I hope everyone understands what I mean with it. It's like one way.
it doesn't empower anyone.
Exactly, though. And there's also a huge rat tail to this, and it's kind of where also the bad news come from, as Adam was also a little bit pointing out how it hasn't worked. And I think this is kind of a new window, like it's where you can take a left and right turn and come back and reverse. And so it has a lot more options, much more adapted to the current situation. And there will be much more refugees and immigration in this world. I think there is like something like climate change immigration has already started, right? And we just see the tip of the iceberg, really. And I'm personally extremely concerned with this conversation because I see this potential danger of people here in the West saying, don't come to us. Or not only so and so many, or they're taking the jobs away, and that's kind of usual thing. And I thought we kind of had already learned from our history that this is not true, and we have to find a solution worldwide for it as humanity, as really one humanity. And it's this one way system of just here is the money, just do something with it, just doesn't work.
Yeah, I think it's not just the money side of it so much as, even employing blockchain technologies to eliminate the middlemen, to get rid of all these layers of administration that occur from the donor to the place of need or the person of need. And if 80 or 90 or 98% of that money goes to the middle people, and so little ends up where the need actually is, to be able to apply technology to say, okay, we're gonna, you know, we're gonna increase that leverage by 10% even, it's pretty spectacular. Thank you, Adam. Keep doing the good work.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.